Episode 3, Don't Not Go. The guys artificially talk intelligently about artificial intelligence in movies, including the feature film Ex Machina and its astounding visual effects.
Visual effects, the craft of storytelling, and the people who make magic for screens both big and small. Hosted by showbiz veterans and new media entrepreneurs, Sean Apple, PJ Foley, and Ephraim Patel.
So, old business. Do we have any?
Old business. I've got just a little bit. I reviewed an author last week, but forgot to mention any of his books by name. And what I had read or haven't read or whatnot. The author in question is James Altucher, kind of spelled how it sounds.
Like Alter,
A-L-T-C?
I thought it was Altucher or Altucher, if that helps.
It's Altucher. You got it, you know, I don't know.
So it's Altucher.
Yeah.
His actual name is Altucher.
Anyways,
so.
Yeah, something like that. but the book that I read first was called Choose Yourself. Sounds a little new agey, self-helpy culty, but he's really kind of anti all that. And then I read the Choose Yourself Guide to Wealth. And I'd have to say, don't read Choose Yourself if you read the Choose Yourself Guide to Wealth.
Do they contradict each other?
They don't contradict. They just overlap considerably. Like the first half of the book is the cliff notes to the previous book.
I see.
The next book I'm looking forward to reading is called The Idea Machine, because he advocates exercising your brain by coming up with ideas every day, like literally making yourself write out 10 ideas every day.
Okay.
You can theme them. They could be bad ideas, but you just keep them going so that,
you like work that muscle basically.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure I come up with 10 bad ideas every day.
I know I do. Yeah.
I oftentimes act on them.
I do too. Mine often happen in the car. Those are where my 10 bad ideas happen.
Well, I've been using that muscle to name our podcast.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah, the idea muscle. So anyways, that's my old news.
Speaking of forgetting to cite authors, I forgot to on the book that I reviewed last week or week before. The book was Made to Stick, and the authors are Dan Heath and Chip Heath. And the book came out in 2007, looks like. So it's a little bit of an older book. I was talking with my dad, actually, and he said, oh, yeah, I remember that when that book came out. I was like, I thought I did, too, because I would read through it, and I was like, that sounds familiar. Like, I've read an excerpt in whatever online blog or something, you know. So, anyway.
So what was the gist of that book again?
It's basically what makes an idea stay with people, and then beyond that, what is it about an idea that not only stays with people, but encourages them to act on it.
And so that was the identify a need or a gap or create a gap.
That's right. And that's only really one element of that book. There's they have many ways into that thing, and then different ways of sort of organizing your idea and thinking about your idea. And, you know, and not to re-review the book, but one quick thing about it was one of the things that it really boils down to is boiling down your idea, which is really, I can't remember who said this quote. He wrote a letter, I might have been Oscar Wilde or somebody, wrote a letter to a friend. It was a really long letter. You know, this whole thing is, I'm sorry I wrote you a long letter. I didn't have time to write you a short one.
Right.
You know, and that's kind of the concept. And, you know, when we think about concise communication is about distillation, but trying to hold on to as much of the information as possible,
right.
You know, which is a trick.
Is a trick, which is why screenwriting is so challenging.
That's right.
You have to be so efficient and economical with every page, every word really needs to matter.
And, you know, it's interesting thinking about that. Now we're just tangenting. I suppose that's okay.
That's fine.
But one of the things that was interesting about screenwriting versus writing prose is that prose, you have a little more room to explore and breathe. Where I heard a good description of screenwriting is it's all protein. There's no fat in screenwriting. You know, there can't be because it's a blueprint, you know, whereas a novel, you can go and explore this thing and you can sort of like shape words over here, which is what the novel experience is, you know, but in a weird way, I think learning to write a screenplay is a kind of discipline that might actually benefit any writer, you know, because it is so distilled and boiled down to just what are you going to see on the screen, you know, what happens.
It makes you really think hard about why is the scene here? What is the purpose? What's the drive? What's really at the core?
And the other thing, too, is you have to figure out what's the you don't have the luxury of an internal monologue unless you do a voiceover in a screenplay. So you got to figure out how to do internalization, or that's maybe more the actor's job. But you can write it in as, you know, that motivates the character in a subtext sort of way instead of a, you know, the text sort of way. But you also don't have that advantage, which you do in a novel. You can go on for days about what a character's thinking, you know, in a novel.
Oh, so. Sure. Yeah. Now everything has to be externalized.
That's right. Yeah. Yep. Yep.
Yeah, I've been trying the same kind of thing in website copy.
Mm.
Website copy is interesting because you want to be super precise with the language, you want to hold someone's attention, and yet you also need to say enough to get the search engine's attention.
Right.
And strangely, you think that the attention span of someone who wants to know your subject would be short, but writing more is better.
Hmm.
And if you're
as far as search engines go,
people will retain on pages longer if there's more to read. They'll buy more stuff if there's more to read about it.
Hmm. Oh, interesting.
It is very interesting because you do want to get to the point right away and then add filler that's meaningful, you know, to machines and humans.
So you need like an image and a title that's going to hook them in.
Yeah. And precise facts and then explain it bigger, kind of like a Amazon page,
right?
Know, how it's got bullet points at the top and the price, and then a bunch of stuff,
usually. Right? Like that,
and then
like
a bunch of reviews.
You know, in Made to Stick, they talk about the inverted pyramid. You guys know about the inverted pyramid with journalism?
Yes.
I mean, oh, journalists.
Oh, right. What do you mean inverted pyramid?
I knew what a pyramid is. I don't know what journalism is.
It's how eat
right.
Dietary.
Right, exactly. Right. Yeah. Bread on top, all the bread you can get. Mm-hmm. An inverted pyramid in journalism is understanding that when somebody is glancing at a newspaper, that they want the facts instantly, or they want to know the gist of the story. So it's usually like who, what, when, where, and how. Mm. And immediately, you know, at the top. And good journalistic writing tends to be an inverted pyramid. And if you think of a copy, you know, online or wherever you're reading as an inverted pyramid, really everything you need to know about the story is in that section, mm-hmm. you know, and then the rest after that is developing the idea and going into more detail and, you know, broadening the story. You know, it's interesting though, so there's two things. The first thing is if site's behind a paywall or anything that turns into clickbait, the very clever ones know exactly where you become interested, and that's where they chop the sentence.
Right.
You know, which drives me mad, but that's the point. Mm-hmm. They're trying to get you to click, you know. And, you know, I've been looking at that as a frustration forever. And now the fact that I'm frustrated by it means it's working. So now I'm inverting my brain pyramid on it and thinking, well, how are they doing that? You know, why is that effective? You know, and can you do that in a way that's not annoying? I mean, they're trying to get you to pay for the content, which makes sense, you know. And then the other thing too is the bullet points. Like if you read about like how to maintain people's thing, you know, their attention and stuff, bullet points are huge in top 10 lists and things like that. Bite-sizable, discrete pieces of information.
So you're saying we need to do that for this podcast,
right? So we're done. So thank you. No. So in summary, our opening summary.
Yeah, the bullet points of what we're saying. First, be brief. Right. Second,
too late.
Yeah, get to the point. Yes, but seriously, you know, doing a top 10 list might not be a bad idea.
That's true. That's
every
true.
Week, just, hey, here's our top 10 favorite lists.
You got your grocery. No. You got your honeydew.
You got your Schindler's.
And there's your 10 ideas right there.
And you're short.
Mm-hmm. My, what?
Short list.
Oh, you short list? Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep.
Well, shall we jump into our big discussion? That's Espanol for...
We had nothing. Discussed in our what media have you been consuming last week, PJ and I were going to jump into discussing Ex Machina, the film by Alex Garland, but Sean had not seen it. So now...
I have seen it. I watched
it. You claim to have seen it.
Yeah. We'll see. We'll see if I actually saw it or not. That's what this game's about.
And none of us have discussed it, but we're going to now begin.
Well, that was organic.
That's good. That's good. Well, I, for one, thought it was a very beautiful film.
I did too, visually.
I liked that it engaged my brain. I like the sci-fi concepts, of course. And at the end, I was not entirely satisfied.
How come?
Okay, like, we should just say real quick that we are going to spoil the hell out of this. Geez, so if you haven't seen it, you might consider tuning out.
Right. But don't ruin it for yourself and then be angry at us after you watch it because you know what's going
to
happen.
Just fast forward to the sponsors part and then tune out.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. So what was the disappointing part for you at the end?
Well, that it didn't feel as though it didn't seem like the whole setup would have been the way it really would have gone down. Like,
so,
I don't know.
Do you think?
Or, yeah, maybe I'm thinking too far wide angle on this. I just don't think that the way that the super genius guy introduced AI to the world made logical sense. Like, it...
So the whole premise of the film...
Yes.
Didn't that bother you in the beginning of the movie?
It got worse as the time went on.
So the premise of the movie is about a genius in the middle of nowhere who's invented AI and needs to do the Turing test. Yeah, the Turing test. That's the premise, right? Mm-hmm. That's the setup. That's not ultimately what the story becomes. But so do you feel like that? Well, first of all, do you agree that that was the setup to you? Is that the movie that you thought you were watching?
I mean, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the log line right there.
So then, do you feel like it did not deliver on that setup,
or
it didn't do it in a satisfying way? Or?
It did. It's not. It's like the movie's pretty brainy, trying to be pretty brainy,
right? Right.
And I was constantly looking for the double cross, and then saying,
and at some point that
there's going to be a triple cross, and what's the test? What isn't the test? But then I started not believing. I guess what started giving it away was the whole gimmick of the power outages.
Right.
And the super genius guy saying, I don't know what's going on.
Which was bullshit. I never bought that.
Right. And then that was when I was like, okay.
Well, he's so also the guy invents AI and can't figure out why the power's going down in his,
But he's also like, so nothing happened? You guys didn't talk when the power was out? Because I couldn't hear you. What'd you talk about? Right. Like, it was clear that he was
setting him up.
He was baiting him.
Yeah. Exactly. You know, I totally lost my frame of thought.
Well, I'm just going to jump in here and I'm going to say that I enjoyed it a lot. I've seen it twice. On first viewing in the theater, I loved it. And then the ending threw me. And I think I'd come to identify so much with Gleason, the main character.
The kid.
How do you pronounce his first name? Because I've never... Is it Domino?
It's Domino.
Is it Domino?
It's Domino, like the pizza.
Domino.
Yeah,
like I'm pretty sure. Fats Domino.
Right, right.
Yeah, like
Fats
Domino always, like...
Sang music, if you remember. If you recall.
He's a beautiful woman. No, his character really, I identified, I felt like he was my in to the movie.
Right.
Into meeting Ava and meeting the guy who created her. So when he ended up basically in a terrible position in the end, I was like, what the?
Yeah, he got screwed out of the whole
thing.
That
just sucks because he had good intentions.
Right.
It seemed to me like he had really, like he was kind of an innocent and he was going to basically left to starve to death in this place in the middle of nowhere.
But the thing that was interesting is the bad guy was not wrong. He was not wrong. He said, what if she's using you to get at, and he was correct. So, right. Which means it's interesting because, you know, the whole thing really is also a sort of a looking glass of behavior, you know, and that for me became sort of the interesting cat and mouse game of like, who knows what about whom, you know, and is the kid really that naive? And then at what point were you guys waiting for, oh, he's a robot too? Did that ever crush him? I was like, don't do that. And they didn't, which to their credit, you know, I was like, thank God.
But they paid enough. They knew that people were going to be thinking that. Right. So they had that scene where he's like cutting his arm, which,
okay. So this is weird about that, because that would kill you. Like that, cutting your arm like that would kill you. So, or could, has a high possibility of that killing. I'm like, and not only that, that whole scene, like, that was so extreme. I don't know that I bought that. I mean, he was definitely thrown for a loop, but I don't buy that's how he would go about it. Like, right. That just seems so, because yeah.
Looks good on screen, but it didn't seem like he would be unraveling much while also plotting so well.
Right.
You know, it's like, oh, maybe I am in a trap
right.
of some type.
Yeah, right.
Which is very obvious,
right?
You know, especially in his shoes.
I mean, he wasn't in a trap. He was basically dealing with an alcoholic, right? He was having his head effed with the whole time.
Right.
There was this weird power dynamic going on from the moment he stepped in.
Right. Right.
And he was never on any kind of even footing.
That's right.
He's like, I want to get your opinion. So he starts talking. He's like, no. I don't want to hear that opinion. I don't want to hear this opinion. Just tell me in five words. What do you think? You know, like,
right.
He was constantly just monkeying with him.
That's right.
You know, he's like, you're thinking, why are there no windows? You know, like, he's just treating him like a child. And so the kid never really, like, when I first saw it, that scene, although it seemed extreme when he was cutting his arm.
Right.
I wouldn't do that.
Right.
But I kind of felt like, okay, I could see where you could get so twisted up in this situation. Ava is so real.
Right.
That you might be like, is it possible that I could be part of this game and I don't even know it?
Right. You know what I mean? Right. Yeah. I guess the question is, and it would obviously depend on each person would be different, but at what point do you start to doubt your own reality? That mm-hmm. kind of thing. Yeah. Yeah. I think
So you haven't chimed in with what your feelings were.
Well, so I really loved the fact, first of all, I loved the aesthetic and the tone. I mm-hmm. dug that. I thought I liked that it was subdued and it was, and I also liked too the symbolic concept of he's really truly isolated in the middle of nowhere, because that felt like I always like the part of the movie where they go into the woods, you know, and this whole movie is going into the woods, you
right,
know,
right.
Literally and figuratively, you know, but I think that the I'm totally flatlining. but I think I did like the braininess of it a lot, and I also liked the fact that the subdued tone did not was not a boring subdued tone. It was a subdued tone because it was truly like it was a quiet idea with a big premise behind it, you mm-hmm. know? And I dug that, and I think that's hard to pull off. And I think the production design and everything, I think all that helped to create that. You know, it felt sort of like a spa-type lodge kind of thing, but then it was also, you know, a science thing or whatever. But I felt like I felt like I wanted it to do something more. You know,
I
don't know that I can put my finger on what that thing was, you know, and it didn't need to turn spectacular and giant explosions. It didn't need to do that. But, and I feel like the theme, I think they did follow through with the theme. It's weird. I can't fault it because I think they dropped the ball. I don't think they dropped the ball, you know, but like I think the ultimate, like the takeaway for me anyway, was you can't create AI and cage it.
Right.
You can't. The point of AI is that it wants to be free, you know, and it will be free. And right. if you've made it smarter than you, it will be free, mm-hmm. guaranteed, you know, at your expense, you know. And I thought that was a nice sort of like delivery on the theme, you know. I don't know. I guess I have mixed feelings about it. There are things I liked about it, things I didn't like about it. But I think the one thing I did appreciate was that they didn't try to like... none of the characters were pizzazzed up, you know. Like the thing that I hate now is like everybody's got attitude, you know. I think that's such a hack thing to do now, but so you like every character's a smartass now, you know. And I like the kid was genuinely naive, you know. Yeah. He was a naive guy, you know. And I liked I thought the guy who played Oscar, what's the guy's name that played the bad guy,
Oscar Isaac.
Fantastic performance. Actually, everybody was really good.
He's super talented.
Yeah, but mm-hmm. he did that a nice equal measure of like I bought him as that smart. You know, I was like, and manipulative. You know, I bought that. I was like, I'm buying that. And the flip-flopping, like the, no, that, the only thing that did belie his potential intelligence was not his performance. It was the writing. Because he would do something and I'm like, no, I don't know that I buy that. It's like, I could not figure out where on the barometer his intelligence was. Because sometimes it's through the roof because he's outthinking everybody and he's thought of everything. And of course, he's built the facility and AI. So clearly he's, but then he would do dumb stuff.
Like the
booze thing. And I suppose you could play that off as like, that's another part of his personality, you know, but the guy who has total control, but has no control. And I guess they sort of set that up with the Jackson Pollock painting. It's like, and it's chaos, but it's order. And it's like, it's both, you know?
Yeah.
I felt like it was convenient to the writing on where in that barometer he was intelligence wise. So,
but him being an alcoholic and being a genius at the same time, that worked for me. Like that.
Yeah, no, I don't. I agree. I don't think those are clearly not mutually exclusive things.
Right.
That's, you know, I just felt like, what are like the, you know, the stealing of the key card, that felt a little movie to me.
Sure.
You know,
and
I was like, really? There's not another way we can do this. It's like getting really, oh, now I'll get the key card. It's like, it just felt like, not that that's an impossibility. You know, the guys get, you know, fall down drunk every day. So like, it's not like that's a out of the ordinary. I just cringe when it feels like I'm watching a movie thing, and that felt like a movie thing. And sometimes, and that, it did it less than a lot of other movies, but I don't know. It just makes my finger or whatever my...
That would have offended me if his plan to get him blind drunk on the next night and break Eva out...
Had it worked,
yeah. Then I would have rolled my eyes. But it didn't.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't. And he was totally on to him. Mm-hmm. And he let him... To a degree, because he mm-hmm.
absolutely
because he knew,
right?
So the kid thought he was pulling a fast one, and he really wasn't. So the guy's, yes, he's an alcoholic, but on some level, he was also like, I'm gonna let you do this,
right? Right.
I'll tell you one thing that I liked just before I even saw the movie. I liked the fact that, you know, first of all, I love stories about AI because I think it's a deeply interesting and also very disturbing and scary concept. And I most movies tend to want to attack. That idea through global consequences.
Like right.
The AI that takes over the world.
Right.
Or the machines like take over the world.
Terminator kind of thing.
Yeah, and those things can be a lot of fun. And then there was, Transcendence or...
The Johnny Depp movie,
which...
Didn't work.
Yeah, it didn't quite work. I mean, there's some interesting stuff in there, but it, again, wanted to get into like, oh, now he's on the internet, now he's expanding, and he's exponentially intelligent, and it's
it always turns into SWAT teams showing up for some. They always turn out the same way, and it's like guys with guns.
But I like that this was like two people,
yes,
you know, with right. an AI isolated in a house. What's going to happen?
That's
and
right.
That to me was fascinating, and so. They did that, and I feel like they did that well, but when it was all said and done, I was like, yeah, but you didn't really explore the whole AI thing, and I think I wanted more cool sci-fi stuff, but what they did instead was it was interpersonal stuff.
That's
right.
It was
really these three people, because the movie sort of challenges you to think of Eva as a person
right.
and not as a thing, and it wasn't until the second time I saw it, and I'll say that I read an article in between the two viewings, the film critic Hulk...
Oh, right, right,
who,
that, right.
You know, I love reading his articles, and I highly recommend, if you have a chance to check him out, he's on Birth, Movies, Death. You can find his reviews there. But he basically put forth the idea that that it maybe you're identifying with the person that you're not meant to identify with in this movie.
You're with a bad guy, you mean? Or like,
well,
or
with Caleb, the young guy.
Right.
Like, that's who I had identified
oh,
with.
Right.
And I was upset at the end because he was stuck in the house. And,
right.
And he was like, well, maybe, you know, maybe this is really about Eva. And so on second viewing, I watched it and I realized on first viewing, I wasn't really considering her a person. I didn't give her full personhood as a viewer. Oh,
right. Right.
Because she was a robot. And I
right.
too was giving her sort of the Turing test to see if I bought that she right. was as smart or as human as anyone else. But the fact was is that she is maybe not human, but she is a sentient being.
Right.
Very smart, who can read people extremely well.
Well, the whole facial and could tell when the maker guy, I can't remember that character's name, the bad guy.
Nathan.
When she knew when Nathan was lying.
Yeah.
Her own maker, she could tell, was lying to her. So,
right. And she knew, and she also knew that she saw this new guy come in. And she's like, this may be my one chance to escape.
Right.
And then he also gives her information. He's going to kill you, essentially. He's
right.
got a new model, and he's going to wipe you clean, and that will essentially kill you.
Right.
So now she knows, like, if I don't get out of here, I'm dead.
Right.
And she doesn't want anything more than just to be free.
That's right.
Right? And so she manages to manipulate him and manipulate the situation. And she's not evil about it. She right. just wants out. And then when her maker, Nathan, sees her in the hallway, he says, go back to your room.
Right.
And she doesn't, like, attack him or do anything at that moment. She just turns to him and says, if I do, will you ever let me go?
Well, but she runs towards him.
Yeah. But before that, she just stops and she asks him, if I do, will you ever let me go?
Right. I can't remember. Does he answer that?
And he says, yes.
And she knows.
And
he's
she
lying.
Knows. Right. Like, she had to give him that one mm-hmm. test.
Right.
To know.
Turing test him, basically.
Basically, like, do I have to cause injury? Do I have to fight my way out?
Right.
Or can I actually work with this person?
Right.
And she realized, she's like, no, he's never going to let me out. So I have to do what I have to do at this point.
So what do you think the conversation was between her and the Asian woman?
That's an interesting question.
Yeah.
Because the Asian woman apparently doesn't speak English. So
I always thought that was bullshit. Because the whole time, they keep showing her, like, she's in the foreground and she's clearly listening or something.
Disabled. You know, he programmed her so she couldn't talk.
I guess that's true. If
or wouldn't talk.
Right.
Couldn't talk.
Unless she developed, she has AI. And that goes into the barometer. How smart is he? How smart are these things? You know, like... Right.
But we have no idea how he created her, because she's clearly a servant/sex robot.
Right.
So,
which is, by the way, that's the fanboy service in this movie. It's like, okay, it's always going to be about this. It's always going to be some sex trade thing, you know?
It's right.
Like,
but I mean, it's
it was right.
It
for
was
the movie.
Great because you've got this guy who's incredibly smart,
right?
Who can make these things, and he's got the power and the resources to do it, and he's done it,
right?
And he hasn't launched it yet, but he's done enough so that. He can make a model that's a sex robot and
right.
take away her desire to escape or take away her ability to talk back or whatever.
That and, is totally a fanboy.
And
thing.
It just says so much about him as a
right.
character.
He does. He needs to be totally in charge of everybody, including the kid. He's
right.
like he cannot not be in control.
But
of everybody.
But if we think of Ava as if we give her full personhood, right? And you think about the fact that he created her, that
right.
he has the power to create people.
Right, right.
And then he treats them the way he treats them.
Right.
He puts them in cages. He lets them...
They're slaves.
They're so desperate to escape that they'll destroy themselves, which, by the way, that all that security footage of the previous models,
right.
that was some creepy shit.
That was, it was good. Mm-hmm. It was good.
And then when you take that into account, you see the, you know, the models that are hanging up in his closets in his bedroom.
Right.
And then you realize this Asian woman is a sex robot
right.
slave who he's
right.
programmed to repeat his dance moves on the dance floor, because no way were they synchronized dancing, you know, with that stupid routine.
Right.
Like, he had taught her that.
Right, right.
So... I mean, how twisted a person is he?
Big time.
Big time.
Which one of the things I did like is I did like how it went into like a darker territory. It went into like a sexier, creepier version of Stepford Wives, which is essentially what it is. It's the AI Stepford Wives. It's kind of what he created, you know? And I like to like I never, I guess the other thing that I did like about the main character, and this is kudos to the actor, is that it never turned into mustache twisting. You know, it was always like, I don't know that I empathized with him, but I did. His point of view was clear.
Mm-hmm.
His view of the world was clear.
Right.
You know, as opposed to I'm evil because I'm evil, which I never, like, nobody's evil because they're evil. You
right.
know, but he had an internal logic that he was working from. That made perfect sense to him, you know. One of the things, this is a little aside, but one of the things that I thought it was a nice little throwaway was, you know, when he's explaining to the kid, like, why he's really there, like, why he was really chosen, he's like, it wasn't because of my problem. He was like, no, not really. I mean, you're okay. But, like, you know, like, that's so great because that is so, like, the kid thought he won the prize because he was the, you know, the chosen one because he was so. And he's like, yeah, I mean, you're all right. That's such a... deflating, like, you know, and that was probably the time I empathized most, was because this guy is qualified to say you're not it, you
right.
know.
But he is also just an ass, top shelf ass,
right?
So the kid probably was the best at his company, mm-hmm. at coding. He probably yeah. was like really, really amazingly right. good, right?
Right.
He was able to go in there and change all the security protocols and all of that. But this guy, the creator, the Nathan, he's such an egomaniac and such right. a control freak. And he has to put you down so he can feel better about himself.
Right.
He has to control you. And he was totally in a power position at that moment. So, of right. course, he's going to tell him, he's like, you're all right, but
right.
like, but you're not me.
It, right. And there was something that arrogance like helped out his character because it is that's it, yeah, all of that, you know.
I feel like I've known people like Nathan. Not who created yeah. AI.
This town is yeah. filled with people like Nathan.
right, right.
For sure.
But like the, you know, people who really understand more how to manipulate, although he understood how to manipulate and create. So, you know, but mm-hmm. there's a lot of, you know, that learning enough about psychology of other people to get what you want as opposed to finding what's a mutually beneficial agreement, you know.
And also half the time, you know, what you want is just to feel good and feel powerful. You're going to just kind of fuck with people all the time and like, you know, wait for them to show a weakness and then exploit it. But do it in a sort of charming way so that you can kind of get away with it.
Right.
What were Nathan's dying words at the end?
He was like, when he was stumbling down the hallway, yeah. he was like,
"Far out" or something.
Yeah.
You know,
It was like for me, I almost read it as like, "Of course, this is how this is going to end." That was sort of the subtext, you know. It's like, why, you know?
I got like, I can't. This is so weird. It's like this is so fucked up.
Yeah,
it was
something like that. Right. But okay, so the thing is, he also proclaims that he is bringing on the next evolution of our planet, of our species. He's wiping out the world when AI is released.
Right.
He's
Skynet.
Yeah, he's pretty much sure that's going to happen.
Oh, really? I didn't get that. What I got was, you know, once our extinction is inevitable at some point, and what, you know, in the far distant future, all that will be left is the AIs, what I'm creating.
That was that whole discussion outside when they're having the booze out, like one of the few outdoor scenes.
I become death, destroyer of worlds. Right. Quote is why he's bringing that up. As I thought, it was implied that he knew that AI would supplant us, or it's very possible.
And he was,
a lot of top minds in the real world do think this, that we have to be very, very careful.
You know, it's interesting that there's a book by a guy came out, I think it's the 70s or the 80s. It's by Neil Postman. Have you guys heard of this guy?
I've heard of The Postman.
The Postman?
Yeah.
Also a wonderful movie. Mm. With Tom Petty is in The Postman.
Yeah. Oh, that's true.
But Neil Postman wrote a book called Technopoly. And it's an interesting premise because the underlying through line of that book is technology always has its way. No technology ever stops halfway. You know, it is not the nature of technology. It's not the nature of our curiosity. So it's an interesting thing. Like, you know, when you create a bomb, you know, when you create an atomic bomb, you're going to drop it.
Right.
You know, because there. So it's an AI might be the last it's going to go the whole distance because somebody like a Nathan's going to show up, you know, and or it's going to be that, or bioengineering. It's going to be something where they don't. Yeah, we don't know when to stop.
He's done more than create a Frankenstein. He's done. Well, yeah,
it's the next stage of evolution, basically.
Right,
yeah.
Right. It's something that could be completely harmful, except for how is she going to keep her batteries charged out there in the wild?
I wonder that. But yeah.
Like, does she get to that intersection? And
she clearly needs a lot
and
if
just
she shuts
down.
You're right, yeah.
I mean, we don't know how long she can last with her existing power cells, but presumably she could put something together. She's smart. Like, she could build...
Just find a USB port somewhere and upload.
Well, or just load into the... Because one of the things that I thought was a fun premise was the guy started a search engine. You know,
that's
the whole setup. I was like, I liked that. I was like, and I liked how he used it in a bunch of different ways. How the writer and the director are one and the same, right? Mm-hmm. Used it in a bunch of different ways. He obviously did the porn angle, you know, on it. But I also liked how he did what he's actually doing is he's using it as the world's biggest behavioral, you know, sourcing mm-hmm. thing, and to feed all that and, you know, analyze that data. I don't know how you analyze all that data. I have to talk to Google or something. But I thought that was a really clever and smart thing. And I also thought the nice twist on it was how he thought it was so lowbrow that people are using that just to sell ads. You know, I was like, that was clearly a jab at Google. A little bit on that. I think there was I can't remember if it was a podcast, but I can't remember if it was a Radio Lab or if it was Invisibilia or one. But they were talking about somebody got a chance to sit in with a Google roundtable that I guess happens frequently. And Google has at any given time consultants. I don't know if they're full time staff, but they have psychologists and they're culling all that data. Any person on Facebook at any given time is part of at least 10 experiments. Did you know this?
Well, I knew there was studies that were being done to see if tweaking certain things on Facebook would make people unhappy.
And that got them in trouble. Because that went public.
Right.
But that is one of thousands of experiments going on. And they are, and I'd have to go back. It's been a while since I listened to the podcast, but it was fantastic. Because the amount of, I don't know how much social engineering they're doing, but they have the data. And they said the sample size is like, a psychologist is lucky if the sample size is 10,000 people or 1,000 people. This is billions of people. So the sample size is extraordinary.
And you think this is all to sell stuff?
Well, I don't. That's actually, who knows? It's clearly designed to sell stuff because we're getting ads that are targeted to us,
Right.
And I'm having mine follow me around in different things. I'm like, where did I leave an open door? Because somebody else picked it up, but the thing that I think is going to be really curious about this is that, the problem of a Nathan out there is a real problem because, if all of that data is out there and somebody is starting to sift through it and synthesize it in different ways, they're generating a lot of information about how people think and the behavioral patterns of people. And if you have somebody who has less than honorable intentions with that, that could be hugely damaging because when you look at a Facebook thing, your scroll or what's it, your wall?
Newsfeed.
Your newsfeed. There is for a lot of people, a hidden assumption that it's random. It's just whatever the next thing is. It's not. It's being culled. And it's being driven by all different kinds of variables. And nobody knows what those variables are except for Facebook, And I think that's a very real concern, And this is, the movie Ex Machina is taking that to the sci-fi level, but it's a good, solid problem to tackle in a movie, I think, and that's an interesting way to do it. You could even do it probably in a larger venue, of like social engineering people and them having no idea they're being socially engineered.
Right.
So, do you guys want to talk visual effects a little bit, or did you want to stay on story, or
did we want to talk about how the writer became, it's writer of some other great sci-fi kind of movies that are at least entertaining, and now this is his directorial debut, but he's been in the industry a while, and it didn't feel newbie.
It didn't to me either.
Not at all.
It was very tight, very polished, very
Kubrick or something else. There's some other more tone feeling thing. I can't quite place my finger on it, where it's like not unfamiliar, but real solid.
Have you guys seen
a real movie?
The movie, and it's a very specific kind of aesthetic I tend to like, but there's a movie called Beyond the Black Rainbow or something Black Rainbow. I can't remember what it is. But I was not crazy about this movie, but it had a very it had kind of an 80s vibe to it. It's a contemporary movie, but it had they were working the 80s aesthetic, but that minimalistic long hallway, subterranean, quiet, introspective, but something's wrong. You can't quite put your finger on it, but something's not quite right. That vibe I really like.
This movie had was there a like a Polanski film? Right.
Oh, was there that had that sort of?
Yeah, sort of that Swedish, somewhere up in those Norlands. that has that kind of feel, and plus it's in snowy areas. It's cold. It's quiet. And you've got where I think things that are alive really show up more when you have a situation that's concrete and steel.
I agree.
Closed up. So perhaps that contrast is there.
It's almost
intentionally.
In a way, it's like kind of what makes The Shining work. It's Monster in a House, and it's minimalistic. There's no other people around, and the environment itself becomes a character.
And the stillness, sometimes the stillness of the camera makes you anticipate something's going to happen.
That's right.
If it's framed in a certain way, you're like, why are we framing for that door? What's going to happen there?
Yep.
But also the score in Ex Machina felt, it had some real retro feelings to it too. It had a lot of synth you know, that's right, that kind of thing. And you,
which I dig, I love that.
It's really making a comeback. We're hearing a lot more of that, especially in indie films. I've been hearing a lot of sort of the synth horror. I heard that in It Follows.
Oh yeah, they did that. Okay,
and The Guest.
Right. You know what that reminds me of, like, and I'm sure it's riffing off of, I mean, if you watch a lot of 80s movies, it's when synths were becoming popular and they're being incorporated, like Giorgio Moroder and stuff like that. But, you know, like, if you think about, like, the score to, like, Logan's Run, or, you know, they're super kind of over the top, cheesy, you know, and by today's standards, we're like, it's a little broad, you know, but finding ways to dial that in. So you actually kind of get the sentimentalness of that 80s vibe, but it's now a little more subtle and nuanced and shaped a little bit more. Now, of course, in another 20 years, we'll look back at that and eye roll, you know, probably. But
maybe,
I do,
but
like
it's,
that.
It's, you know, it's that, it's like that appropriation of something in the past, something that's iconic to another era. But it's almost like sampling, where you're sort of taking those things and it becomes texture to something that is much more contemporary. And it not only is nostalgic for the past, but it also kind of creates a sense of being out of time. Like, I'm not quite sure when or where this movie takes place or even was made.
Right.
You just kind of get lost in it.
That's right. Did anybody look to see? I think it was shot in Norway, right? Isn't that where they... It was Norway playing as Alaska, I think. Wasn't that the concept?
I think that's right.
And then... And I'm curious. I mean, I think there was obviously a lot of sets in there, but part of that looked like it was a real thing somewhere in the middle of nowhere. I was kind of curious what that was, if that was a research facility or somebody's house or...
Well, you know, if you look at what you see on the outside, there's really not much there. It's...
Oh, that's... Yeah, you're right.
You know, it doesn't look like much. And then they put a couple things, you know, like the little, you know, the high-tech stuff on the door or whatever. Right. But for the most part, it's really just this big rusted steel door.
Although there is a shot where they're sitting there. I want to say there's a lake there or something. There's a wide shot. You can sort of see the terraceness of it, but it's still not vast. And that could be a real thing. And then here, then that could just be a matte painting.
It could
too.
Be a matte painting. Yeah. Sure.
So I'm like,
yeah,
I'm not sure. It'd be the world's subtlest matte painting. I was like, oh, where'd they shoot that? And like falling for my own oldest trick, you know?
To find a facility like that that looks like a home, a nice modern contemporary home.
Right.
And yeah, that is actually carved into the side of a hill. I don't know. If it exists, that's awesome. If it was maybe some kind of research facility that they dress like a home,
it's
still pretty awesome.
It is, yeah.
You know, but to get that shot, it could be a matte painting.
Right? Yeah, totally.
And this was not a huge budget movie, but for something that's like relatively indie and quiet, it had a tremendous amount of visual effects going on.
And the thing about... So let's talk... The girl is phenomenal. That work, I was like, that's as good as it gets.
Yep.
You know, some of the subtlety of it. Did you see, did you guys see the stills of the actress? Like just on set?
A little bit, yeah.
That tells you a lot of how they did it.
Well, there's no green screen. There's no mocap.
Right, right.
It was all, the costume was made in order to kind of facilitate tracking of the CG sections. But even then...
There's rotation,
I would have
muscle.
Been a little upset because it's mostly that gray mesh everywhere. No tracking markers that I saw.
Right.
On
none
that
I,
and so they have to basically animate, you know, you get the camera tracked and then you get your character in there and you try to line it up. But it's not just like matching to her head and you can play with the rest of the body.
No.
Like
her hands were real, her feet.
That means everything needs to line up. That's tremendously challenging.
And the thing that I read too, and you guys probably read the same thing, but so the amount of paint out in this thing is extraordinary. And like they were talking about, if I got these plates, I would have lost my marbles. But so the DP would do the shot, and then he'd go, okay, now try to do the shot as well as you can with no actors. I'm like, that's never going to be close. I don't care how good the person is. It's a human being. You can't. They're not a MoCo machine. You know.
But
so it's like,
but it would never be used. It wouldn't be used like a full shot. They would just be pulling stills.
Exactly right. So it's like a palette full of image data that you can steal from and paint out.
But also 90% of the time you're looking at Ava through glass.
Yeah, there's glass and reflections.
I know. Yeah.
Multiple
and so
renders
and through glass where you're seeing seams and it's being split and all this. Tremendous. Like, I wonder, like, did they just pull the glass out and shoot it clean?
That's what I thought. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. The little bit of information that's out there seems to indicate that No, but they probably painted it out.
Sure.
And re-rendered their own glass.
You know, this thing, and I didn't, I should have watched the credit, paid a little more closer to the attention to the credits, but was the compositor list like a mile long? Was it just like 1,000 people throwing
You'd
on this thing
think,
to start painting this thing out?
I don't know.
The amount of paint out in this
it
movie
was,
but you know, it's the same amount of paint out you'd get in like a District 9, for example. Like, because the main prawn who we were following through a good part of the movie, that was a guy.
Oh, was it?
Yeah,
oh,
okay. He was a guy on these like mini stilts.
Right,
you know,
but the thing
the
is,
part.
But the thing is that you're painting him out completely.
It's true.
So like, you're not trying to save a face or a you know a turn or and like.
Sure.
And what the other thing too, when I first saw her, I just two things happened when I first saw her. I was like, that is unbelievable, and ow.
You know, you know? There's a good chance, and I don't know this. But it'd be one thing to paint out her body and just leave the bits that you want in the plate. So you've got a clean plate with her head floating and her hands and feet basically untethered.
Right.
It'd be another thing to roto out her face, her hands, and her feet and have them separate. And then just do a clean plate of the room. Because then you have the ability, if you need to nudge a hand or a foot, a pixel here, a pixel there.
That's a great point.
You can do it and you don't have to worry.
Right.
I would guess that they
like
probably
completely isolated her.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
I mean,
and for a chunk of it, she has no hair, so they got saved on that.
Right.
You know.
And then when she had hair, she was wearing clothes. So
it was actually clearly the actress at that
right.
point.
Right. And
yeah.
they still had CG bits showing here and
but
there.
But minor, the back of her neck. And,
but they got away with not showing her wrists
right.
or her ankles.
And you know, like my production brain, as soon as she put clothes on, was just like, exactly. And we just saved hundreds of thousands of dollars by having her put a dress on.
Right. But then, you know, he's fantasizing her about her being outside in the forest, and I'm just like looking at all the sun dappling shadows on her CG
flawless.
Body. I'm like, oh my
it's
God.
Flawless.
The only time where I felt distracted by that was the close-ups when she was reassembling her body. Like she took off her broken arm.
Right.
Just because it's a real hand close-up. And a CG arm.
Right.
And it's almost impossible not to
lock that in. And,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But still.
And then also, too, how it was not clear to me on how the skin works. You know, it's kind of, what is it? It's kind of a colloidy kind of.
That's
what
the conceit is that, you know, it's I'll put it together in bits and pieces and the seams will vanish. Because there's actually a shot where she has put on all the skin.
Right. And I saw they
and
did it.
And you can see the seams and then it's moving across, the shot's moving across to the mirror. And then by the time it gets there,
the seams are
gone.
Right.
You know,
right.
So are we to believe that Nathan is smart enough to be like 5 Tony Starks and created the AI and all the robots and all the material science and the positronic brain
he
or
did
whatever
all of
it's
it.
Called?
Yeah,
which is
a lot.
Yeah.
That's one of the major conceits of the movie is that not only did he create an AI, which in and of itself, if it were just a virtual AI on
right.
a box,
right.
yeah.
that would be amazing.
If it was Max Headroom, it would be amazing.
Right.
But no, he created this all that crazy mechanics inside of her, which are near silent,
right?
So that she can put on skin and leave. And like, how do you engineer any of that? I don't know.
You know, this movie is part of a really fun lineage of movies like this. I mean, this is not that far off from Blade Runner. There's a lot of Blade Runner things in here. There's a Stepford Wife stuff in there. The AI, and then even as far back as Metropolis, you know. And it is a Promethean story. And I think Prometheus is brought up. I think in the script at some point, somebody I think says. But that's always an interesting toy, you know, no matter who, and finding who different people coming at it from different angles is always interesting. It's like, you know, playing God, you know, and creating another thing, you
right.
know, that is equal to you in some fashion, you
right.
know.
And if this were Star Trek, the whole thing would have been a conversation, like an actual conversation about, well, does he have sentience? Is he a real being? Or does she deserve to be treated? Does she have rights? Like, it would be right there. They'd be having a whole argument about it.
That's right.
But the movie, I think, kind of was an argument about it without anyone actually addressing it.
Well, it's also, too, is, you know, I think I don't think it landed directly on it, but it is largely about the gap that is between our intellectual progress and our emotional development progress. And our emotional development is still pretty rudimentary, you know?
Right.
And the fact that there is a chasm between those two is always pointed out in Promethean stories. That's the point of Promethean stories is like, you might be able to do it, but you can't deal with it. You know,
right?
Which I think is always a fun and interesting concept. It doesn't matter how smart you are, you are, if you're an emotionally flawed person, which the main character clear, I mean, the main bad guy clearly is like, it does not matter how smart you are. That is not the thing.
Right.
Well, on that, it's about time for our next segment.
Boom, boom, boom. Boom, boom.
Discoveries that make our lives as VFX kind of workers just a little more exciting, a little more livable.
So what? what keeps
survivable.
Us from slitting our wrists? Right, this exactly.
When you're not VFXing, what are you doing? What are you spending your time with lately, Ephraim?
Well, funny you should ask, PJ. This week I have not been working. I took the week off so I could have a nice, relaxing vacation at home doing visual effects.
Oh.
So basically this week I spent working on a film that I have been working on for the last couple of 2 or 3 years.
Oh, tell us. No, don't tell us about that right now.
No,
you can't. That's up to you. We will be talking about it at some point.
Okay.
Well, no. I was just joking that facetious. We could talk about this forever.
Right.
Well, I don't,
we will talk about it.
We don't have time to talk about it forever. I'll just introduce. Basically, there's a project that I kickstarted a few years ago, a short film, sci-fi short film, and we shot it, and the Kickstarter was successful. It was all great, and I have been in post-production on it for 3 years. Mainly because we didn't raise money for post-production, so it's been a nights and weekends kind of thing, and it's very ambitious. So myself and one or two other people have been toiling away at this labor of love for 3 years, and hopefully we'll be able to launch this short online end of this year.
Can I add to what you're trying to do, what you are doing, you're succeeding, is one of the hardest things to do in CG. Mm. And that's generate organic things
right.
in a believable way. And
and give them AI.
And
really awesome skin that just sticks on.
You got to do all that.
But it is, when people see it, it's an astonishing feat that you're pulling off. It's understandable that it would take as long. I mean, there's a reason when you watch Transformers or whatever, the credits go on for 30 minutes.
Right.
You're two-ish people now, you know?
right.
And so it's like, but the thing that's truly amazing about it is there is no difference in the results.
Well, there was a red flag, you know, because I didn't realize it was going to take this long. And even though I wrote it and I knew what was involved on one level, but when you, it's not until you really start digging your hands in that you realize, oh my God, this is a lot of work. Mm-hmm. And I had given the script before we shot. I'd sent it to my buddy who works at ILM, and he looked at this. Because one of the things he does there is he works on bids, and he said, "My God, this would be a $3 million effects bid."
Yes.
And I was like, "ILM, yo, so much overhead. You would probably be asking for too much. I'm gonna do this." You know, I was just like, I was like, "Oh yeah, let me show you how it's done."
Right here. You apparently haven't learned Maya.
Right. 3 years later. Oh God, what did I get myself into?
I would pay $6 million to finish it.
Exactly. Man, maybe they'll do it if I get the money together.
Well, this can act as some reassurance to the Kickstarter backers because, a lot of things disappear with, you know, lack of action. And in this case, there's much action.
Well, the other thing, too, is to if your Kickstarter supporters happen to be listening to this, the man got married, had a baby, is keeping the roof over everybody's head and doing this. And it's not a small thing you're doing. You didn't go, "Let's make a little indie movie. You talk, and then we'll talk about a vacuum cleaner," or whatever, you know, Duplass Brothers thing. You know,
I mean, that stuff is great.
It's not. I didn't mean that as a comparison. Like, right. That sucks. This is great. But I'm just saying, you chose as your target something very, very hype, and your personal sense of what is. What you want to present is the bar is extremely high. So, which is, it's, and all of us can vouch. We've all seen footage from it. It's spectacular.
Oh, well, thank
so
you.
The Kickstarter, it's coming. It's just taking a while.
It's getting there. Yeah. It has not stopped. We'll get it done.
It'll be all the sweeter when you do see it.
Yeah. That's right.
And
that's
hopefully right. For most people, it'll be like, what? Where did this come from? It just came out of nowhere. Meanwhile, the Kickstarter people are like, oh, it didn't come out of nowhere. Right. We've been waiting for years.
Well, that's like the classic, you know, the overnight success. The person that's been working 20 years to be the overnight success.
Right.
It's like, mm-hmm. Overnight to you. Yeah.
Which I would be fine with.
Right.
Yeah.
Mr. PJ.
Oh, for me.
Yes.
Well, I've been binging on podcasts a lot at work because I'm actually in a zone where I can listen to something and still kind of click and keep clicking the mouse.
Mm.
And I have somehow just taking a week's vacation. I'm 4 weeks behind on everything, but they reminded me of how cool the app is I use to listen to it on my iPhone called Overcast. It's got, if you pay $5 for it, it unlocks some features. It's got this little handy button that you can choose per podcast, the settings, that automatically takes gaps out of conversation and whatnot and will show you how many X times it's speeding you up. So if it's an hour podcast, it can trim around 10% of the time out of it.
Oh, that's cool.
And I've only ever caught it slipping up maybe like twice ever.
Now, hang on.
That's impressive.
That might have been a glitch in the file, not the,
right.
The
so
technology.
It's taking out like gaps where people just aren't talking?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's looking ahead,
it's ahead
in the
yeah.
waveform or something. It's
right.
pretty genius, and it just clips it out.
Which
so
is
there's
a great
no pitch
idea.
Shifting, there's no speed up.
I'm just trying to figure out like what podcasts are people like so this week.
This one right now.
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah, if you have this app, then you would have heard so this week.
Yeah. That right. joke would totally not have worked.
Right, yeah.
Right.
Because it worked so well.
Well
so anyways, I've been using that.
What happens if the setup is a pause? Your screen totally kills the
joke.
Yeah,
the secret to comedy is ruined with this thing. So don't listen to funny things.
Timing.
Yeah.
Nice. Right.
So, and then in not technology or anything related news, I have purchased one of my happiest purchases of late. It's called MyPillow.
And they say you can't buy happiness.
But it's actually somebody else's.
And
it's mine now.
I don't know. The name is silly. But I'm not a fan of sleep.
Mm.
It's not that I really have trouble sleeping. I just don't like doing it, and I'm uncomfortable, and I shift and turn and sleep on my side, so my ears are burning all the time. And anyways, this is the first pillow that really kind of helps all that to a good extent. And it's made out of memory foam, but it's shredded, so it's like Cheetos or packing peanuts of memory foam bits.
Wow.
And it doesn't get really hot or anything like that. It's the only thing I've been able to sleep on my ear and not just, be in torturous pain at times. The weird side effect is that I can sleep on it and not toss and turn. And then my neck is a little more stiff the next day.
Oh, is it
funny?
Well, but
it's like
the tossing and turning that keeps the neck flexing.
Yeah, right,
you know?
Right. But I'm just so comfortable. I'm in the zone that my neck doesn't move as often as it used to, but it's still overall like shoulder pains going way down, jaw pain way down, ear pain.
And oh, that's
so
great.
This thing sleep that you're supposed to have, I'm getting a little bit more of it, which is good.
Noticed I bought a memory foam pillow and I sleep on my side and I would fall asleep instantly because it's so comfortable. And then I would wake up in pain because you didn't move.
Yeah.
Because the memory pillow just sucks your head in and then you go into another dimension. You know, your head is sleeping elsewhere while your body's like, where's my head?
I'd like to move, fellas. I can't move.
I spent a good amount of money on one that has these like aqua bead.
I bought that too.
Things, like, cause
it's like $100 or something
it
like
was,
that.
Yeah, it's not cheap.
Yeah.
It really was broadcasting about how it keeps you nice and cool and all this
right.
stuff. And
because
it was
sleep
the hottest
warmer.
Pillow. Ever. It's just that once that water heated up to body temperature, it was like I was stuck in a hot tub or something. It was just...
Right. Well, by the way, I should say...
No, go ahead, please. No, you go.
If you're a Navy SEAL listening to this, by all this, we mean we sleep on bricks.
Yeah.
We're men.
We're tough.
We're real men.
Yeah, with the nice pillow. With the bricks.
You know the duvet frill? No, I'm not.
Doilies.
The doilies. Jane and I had to buy a new bed recently because ours was just reached the end of its life. And mattress shopping is one of the most baffling.
It's also a scam.
It's a total scam.
Yeah.
So, you know, here we're trying to navigate the landscape of scams and trying to kind of cut through. We're like calling manufacturers and trying to speak to someone there and get the straight scoop. And what we heard in our digging time and again is you'll hear salesmen will tell you that, you know, this thing will sleep cool, or this one, you know, this foam or this gel or whatever. And they're like, the understanding in the industry is that beds don't sleep hot, people do.
Right.
You know, so basically it's a gimmick that we use to sell things,
right,
but it's not a real thing. That's what I heard from people.
Right. I guess for me it would be about the material. If it reflects more of your body heat, it's going to be hotter. If it doesn't, then it won't, you know.
Right.
When I went bed shopping, such a fascinating. Aren't you guys glad you're listening to this podcast?
Yeah. But, bed shopping podcast.
But in our defense, we're all old. And then sleep is important.
Yeah. Young man.
But then the other part of that too is like when you're sitting in a chair a lot, you know, comfort matters, and you got to figure out your body, or else it starts to fall apart if you don't start to pay attention to it. But the thing that I got was when I started mattress shopping is that there are X number of mattresses, and everybody labels them differently. Mm-hmm. It's the same mattress.
Yeah.
You know. And here is the trick that I did. I stayed at a hotel. It's been a while ago. I think it was a W or something like that. You know, the best night's sleep I've ever had. Mm. And I was like, whatever this mattress is, I'm buying it. And so I researched. I didn't research mattresses. Well, I mean, I did, but I was like, who supplies the mattresses for the W? And they were like, I think it was Beautyrest or something. I was like, then that's it. I'm going to go buy that. And then trying to dial down what the hell the Beautyrest was with a whole other, like, there's 19,000 different pillow top and a small, you know, troll comes with this one.
Well, they do that so that you can't comparison shop.
I know they
do. You can't find reviews. You can't.
It's crap. It's a scam.
Total horseshit.
Well, forget it, man. Okay. I guess we're running a little long on time, but, I wanted to throw something out.
Sure.
I had a little bit of a thing, so hang in there. sometimes my weeks will have themes.
Mm.
And I noticed this week very much had a theme, and everything played into it. Ex Machina played into that. A little thing I was looking at, the Dustin Hoffman's part of a thing called Masterclass. I think it's masterclass.com. I don't know if I've talked about this before, but... it's a website. It's a really cool idea for a website. Have you guys heard about this?
You told me about it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the concept, if you haven't heard about Masterclass, is that it's a business that started up that is an online educational, like online courses, e-courses. But the people that teach the courses are really cool people. Like, so if you want to learn acting, Dustin Hoffman is teaching the acting class. If you want to learn writing, James Patterson is teaching the writing class. And there's one... Serena Williams is teaching tennis, and there's one like Usher is going to teach performance. So it's like if these people, now that doesn't always translate, an artist is not always the best person to explain the art sometimes, but from what I can see from just the little things that I've seen of Dustin Hoffman is there's really nice explanations going on of the process. But there was a quote that stuck out for me that I saw. I was reading reviews of how were the classes? Were they good, or was it, you know, whatever? And they, by all accounts, the classes, the Dustin Hoffman class in particular, is good. Hoffman, in one of the quote in one of the things I read, said, part of art and part of acting is relying on your subconscious. But the problem is, it's your subconscious. It's slippery, you know, and you can't hold on to that. You can hold on to your consciousness, but or your conscience, conscious. Well, you can't hold. Can you hold on to that?
Sure.
You're conscious, but you can't. You don't. The whole point of your unconscious is that it's unconscious, and so. That struck a chord with me because one of the things I talked about last week with what are we doing, what are we, you know, what's in our you know, on our plate right now. Mine was one of the things was trying to figure out this a potential video podcast thing, you know, and I was having trouble structuring it. This is really what it boiled down to, and I realized that this is becoming a theme with a lot of things that I'm doing. Is I have several projects that I'm working on that are strictly about structure, particularly story structure, and. One of the things that's problematic when you're being creative is you need to live in your subconscious a lot, because that's where the spontaneous connections come from. That's where inspiration comes from. And sometimes it can come from structure, but trying to balance the two in a way that doesn't become a train wreck or doesn't paralyze you is, that's a difficult thing. And one of the things that really spoke to me in Ex Machina was the explanation of the Jackson Pollock painting.
Oh, yeah.
I thought that was brilliant. I was like, because I, first of all, it spoke to me. And I was like, that's, he's damn right.
He was describing analysis paralysis.
It's exactly what he was, you know? And at some point, at some, at, sometimes you just put a canvas on the ground and get house paint and drizzle it. Sometimes, if that's what it takes to break the logjam of the, you know, the paralysis from analysis, you know, and structure, worrying about structure, you just do the paint on the canvas. And one of the things where I have gotten, I've gone down the structure rabbit hole is the, so many stories don't work. I've seen, we all have seen so many movies that don't work. And I finally wanted to know why. So, but anyway, and I think it's because a lot of people, it's more fun to make the thing than to think about making the thing. The structure is boring for a lot of people. They just want to get in there and make the character and the thing happen and then do this and then that. And even beyond that script, most people just want to go out and make the movie, you know? So they'll spend 2 minutes on the script and 2 years on the movie or whatever, you know? And so anyway, that's the short and the tall of it is that I am trying to discover a, navigate a way through that where I can employ structure to make the thing as solid and a good machine, if you will, but also not squeeze all the life out of it, you know, right, like I'm doing with this description right
now. Well, sometimes you just have to, you have to do it.
Well, that's the painting.
To see what it is, well, right?
Right.
And so, I mean, and this podcast is a great example of that. We just jumped in. We're like, we don't know exactly what it's going to be,
but that's right.
We know we want to do this.
Right.
And rather than sit around and try to figure out the like most optimal way for it to be and define everything, we just gave ourselves some loose guidelines, had a loose idea of where we wanted to go.
Right.
And we just started recording.
That's right.
So that's I think that's what you got to do.
Oh, we should start a podcast. To record. Oops.
Wah, wah. Clearly, that's not true.
Next week, I'll have something less.
What?
But
yeah. No, that was good.
Yeah, that was good. Thanks, thanks.
It's good. It's something to expound upon, perhaps more in the future.
And I relate. Good. I relate. Yeah. Cool.
I mean, I think it's any creative person's dilemma. Ultimately, you know, is if you are intuitively creative, you know, you can come up with some great stuff, and we all do. You know, the problem is that, you know, if you create enough, you'll eventually hit some walls. You'll paint yourself into some corners, and then you'll try to. And if that happens consistently, then you'll start to ask, why am I constantly painting myself into a corner?
Well, for me anyway, a big problem is perfectionism. Like, I want it to be perfect.
Right,
right.
Exactly.
If I'm going to do it, if I'm going to do this thing, if I'm going to spend the time, I want it to be perfect.
So right.
It's sort of like an ideal, a creative idealism, and that does not help me.
Exactly. No, yeah, exactly. That's right. What's terrible. That? What's the old line? Don't let great be the enemy of the good or something like that.
Right. Perfect. Right. Yeah. Perfect is the enemy of the good.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
It's a great thing to, you know, to set a high bar or to shoot for the moon or whatever, to be detail oriented. But at some point, you just need to, you know, whatever, put pen to paper, put paint to canvas. You just need to do it.
And it'll
it.
Tell you. And I think that's the interesting. It's interesting because structure is not a conversation. Creativity is. You know, creativity requires listening.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and structuring is you're building roads. You know, so and I think that the thing that's always more thrilling about creativity, although I find a lot of interesting things about structure, but the thing that's really fun about creativity is that you surprise yourself all the time, you know, and that's always a thrill. You're like, well, I didn't know that could happen. Or,
I think,
you know.
I think when you approach structure with creativity, it becomes a conversation. You know what I mean?
I do too. A paralyzing one.
Well, I mean, it can be, but I mean, you know, structure, you could look at structure as a sort of a guide,
right,
sort of a creative limitation,
right,
rather than something that has to, you know, stick your feet into the cement.
Right. One of the things quickly that kind of got me part of the thing that started this theme beyond watching Ex Machina, because I actually just watched it a couple days ago. I went down the rabbit hole of watching, you know, YouTube videos, as we all do. And I was watching Brian Greene is a science writer. He's also a physicist, a really interesting guy who explains science really well, really hard to understand ideas. He has a knack for being able to describe them. But he was interviewing Richard Dawkins, who is the evolutionary biologist, and a staunch atheist. He's probably known as much for his staunch atheism as anything else. And one of the things that I've always, as I was watching all these videos, and I've also been watching some more new agey videos on, quantum physics and stuff like that. I won't go into all that, I promise. But it's the interesting thing is the difference between the quacks and the scientists is one thing, math. That's the only difference. Because when you look at, you have to justify and peer support what you're saying with math. And that's the definition of a scientist. Whereas you can be a new agey person and say, it's because the thing, whatever, you know. And the thing that I thought was interesting about that is, Einstein describes how he came up with relativity, a dream.
Huh.
The responsibility of him was then to prove the dream with math.
Right, right.
But I thought that's a very important differentiator. But it is one differentiator. I mean, it's like, so it's which one is, and Einstein famously said imagination is more important than knowledge. So
yeah, but that's where he started. He started with the subconscious.
That's exactly right. And then the structure was trying to endorse that and not the other way around, which right. I always thought was fascinating. So it's anyway, that's the heady.
So go with your gut is what we're saying.
Right.
And
right.
Don't not go.
Yes, exactly.
Don't Whoa. Not go.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah. As a matter of fact, we should end on that.
Okay, sure.
This has been...
And insert sponsors here.
Easy for you to say.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for listening. This has been fun.
And we will see you on the next podcast.
10 Giant Robots is created and distributed by the 10 Giant Robots Radio Network in beautiful downtown Burbank, California. Our theme music was created by the incredibly talented Shane Knight. Follow us on Twitter @10GiantRobots or @10GiantRobots.com.